Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. And then there was word of an Illinois legislator and congressional neophyte just 2 years in Washington who turned his attention to the presidency in a time of national crisis. His name was Abraham Lincoln. Expect to hear a lot about Mr. Lincoln as neophyte Illinois Senator Barack Obama makes his newly minted run for the White House. Yesterday came the first formal signal that Obama, African-American with a story all his own, is going for it. Next month, in Springfield, Illinois, where Honest Abe made his House Divided speech, Obama will make it official. Up next on Point from the Land of Lincoln, Barack Obama sets his sights on the White House. Joining me first today from Washington, D.C. is Jeffrey Goldberg. He covers Washington and national politics for The New Yorker magazine. Jeffrey Goldberg, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Jeffrey.
Jeffrey Goldberg, hi. First to you. How does this rock fall in the pond? What's the reverb today in the nation's capital?
Well, it's enormous. Consider where we were a year ago on these questions when we were talking about Hillary as the prohibitive front runner and a bunch of people following her. Now we have a completely different thing, and really a completely different thing in many number of ways. I mean, we're in a post-racial environment, at least in Washington, but people haven't really focused on the fact that this is the first time in history where we have a black candidate with a credible chance of winning a major party primary and winning the presidency. It's quite an incredible thing.
We're going to talk about how it hits the Democratic field, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton and all the rest. But what about the Republicans, Jeffrey Goldberg? How do they see Barack Obama as the potential contender to vie with their ultimate candidate, whoever that may be?
It's an interesting question. I had a couple of conversations about that yesterday. On the one hand, they're pleased. Some people are pleased. He's a wet behind the ears senator. He's the Republicans at least consider him to the left of Hillary, and that's an important calculation in the general election. There are also a lot of people who are frightened of him. I mean, they see this guy as a huge talent. Who has a message? And remember, he's very interesting in this field of Democrats in that he opposed this war before it was a war, before it became exceedingly unpopular. And the Republicans know that they're going to have a terrifically hard time winning anything in 2008 if this story continues as it's gone on. And so they recognize that this guy is a formidable person. I asked the question, of course, you know, which one would you rather go up against, Hillary
right.
or Obama? And two of these people that I talked to said Edwards.
None of the above.
Jack none Beatty. Of the above. They gave me none of the above.
Right. Jack Beatty, is this a game-changing candidate, Barack Obama? Or does he get pulled into the same game, the same meat grinder as everybody else?
He will get pulled into that, and I think the drama of this campaign, or one element of it, will be how he stands that, and whether his message, which is a complicated message, but which finally comes down to a message of unity. He says again and again, no one is exempt from the search for common ground, he writes in his book. He speaks of common values. He speaks of the importance of political empathy, seeing the world through the other's shoes. He speaks of the importance of being alive to countervailing values that rebut our own preferred positions. And he sees the Constitution, he writes, is a way of marrying passion and reason, individual freedom, and the demands of community. He's all about synthesis. Kenya, Kansas, white, black, liberal, conservative. That's a message lots of Americans want to hear, and they want a politics that talks about our common values and seeks common ground. Whether he'll be able to run the gauntlet of the media machine that'll insist on your, you know, pegging him liberal or pegging him this, is another question.
Jeffrey Goldberg, what about it? A theme of unity there. References to Abraham Lincoln already emerging here. He's going to make his formal announcement, we're told, in Springfield, Illinois, next month, possibly in the old state capitol building, the very building where Honest Abe made his House Divided speech. Lincoln certainly, in the end, was a game changer. And talk about unity, he had a civil war, and you know, the country came out whole. Do you see Barack Obama as a game changer, Jeffrey Goldberg?
Can you believe that we're talking about this guy who nobody ever heard of 2 years ago as an Abe Lincoln?
Well, it's a different thing,
I guess.
Right. That's the reference that his campaign is going to
work
with, and somehow the theme relates.
In New York politics, that's known as chutzpah, but, you know, we'll take it because it's interesting, if nothing else. You know, that works for a while. I mean, I've had a few encounters with Obama. He is that rare kind of politician who, you know, you sort of like as a guy and you want him to like you. He has an incredible magnetism. He has a positive message. He has a positive, interesting, uplifting background. But no, I mean, this doesn't last forever. I mean, he's got to tell us what he's going to do about Iraq. I mean, there's going to be a lot of pressure bubbling up pretty quickly for him to decide. I mean, this is quotidian stuff compared to whether he's a new Lincoln or not, but he has to tell
but
us.
Hardly quotidian, right.
What?
But hardly quotidian. It's a
well,
war.
Hardly quotidian, right. I mean, whether we get out of Iraq or stay in Iraq, or what's our strategy for dealing with the war on terror? How is he going to actually confront Iran and North Korea? I mean, these are important questions. Put aside every other domestic challenge that there is. The next president, whoever it is, whatever party, is going to be inheriting an enormous mess, and people are going to need to know, and in particular, the Democratic base is going to want to know, well, are you with Ted Kennedy, who is calling for a cutoff of funding for the war, or are you not? And some smart Democrat is, and it's probably going to be John Edwards, is going to say, I'm for Kennedy's proposal, and that's going to resonate in a huge way with the Democratic base.
The questions are going to come fast and furious. We talked with Barack Obama last October, just before the midterm elections. Here's a little clip from that conversation where he addresses whether he believes it's still possible for a candidate to speak from the heart and to speak with candor.
The question of whether the better angels of our nature, when it comes to our political system, can overcome the darker impulses in our politics I think the jury is still out, and I believe that we can, but as many people have noted, in some ways, you know, I have not been tested in that fashion and on the national stage, and so you know, I'll be testing it out over the next several years, and we'll report back to you in terms of whether my head is bloodied but unbowed.
Jack Beatty, there's the reference right there. Better angels of our nature, old Abe hovering behind this African American man in reference there. Do you see in his personal history, Jack, that kind of background that lends itself to game changing or game adopting?
I do. I mean, Henry James said it's a complex fate being an American. Well, my God, think of the complex fate this man's had. White and black, raised in Hawaii, lived for 5 or 6 years in Indonesia, always asking himself, where do I belong? In what community do I belong? How do I reconcile my desire for freedom with my group? And what is my group? He's had to reflect, as his books show, on these basic questions of identity and belonging. And I think that obviously he speaks to any immigrant experience, which is in some ways the natal American experience. But it also I think it speaks to the desire the country has to search for something new, some synthesis that would say bring the best of the 60s, individual freedom, tolerance, and so on, forward, but also unite it with what was left behind, common values, solidarity, commitment to one another, feelings about the country. And I think people have long wanted those things to be reconciled. And his personality, his whole life story, which is a blending of opposites, I think lends itself. In other words, his story is aligned, I think, with a very plausible national story.
Jeffrey Goldberg, it is an extraordinary story, kind of one of a kind here. when the artillery get trained on it, how much vulnerability or invulnerability do you see in that? Are Americans ready to line up by the story, or you know, are the swift boat vulnerabilities wide open?
The answer is yes and yes. I mean, there's a big part of America that's ready to accept this, especially now in a very divisive time, to accept a guy whose skin is a unity of two different skins. You know, it's quite astonishing. There are also people, and look, these are things that are not tested. That's one of the reasons this Democratic primary is going to be so interested. We've never had a woman as a plausible candidate for commander-in-chief, and now we have an African-American as a plausible candidate for commander-in-chief. A lot of things we don't know yet about how the country is, if the country is ready for this sort of thing. I will say that another Republican I talked to, and I'm sure you've heard this already, he refers to Obama as Barack Hussein Obama, with the emphasis on the Hussein, his middle name, and he does that for cynical reasons, but because he doesn't care that the guy's middle name is Hussein, but he thinks that a large number of American people will care.
We're talking this hour about Barack Obama setting his sights on the White House and what that means for the presidential race. Here is Senator Barack Hussein Obama delivering the keynote address at the Democratic National Convention, his big coming out party, 2004. In describing his own background here, he seemed to find a way to try to bind together Americans' fractured notions on race and immigration and opportunity.
My parents shared not only an improbable love, they shared an abiding faith in the possibilities of this nation. They would give me an African name, Barack, or Blessed, believing that in a tolerant America, your name is no barrier to success.
Obama 2004, you can join the conversation. Are you putting out the red, white, and blue bunting for Barack Obama? Are you reserving judgment? Are you opposed? And what does it mean to have an African-American in the top tier of White House contenders for the very first time? In the case of Obama, how important is race? And what about experience? Is 2 years in the Senate enough? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Rick is calling from Upton, Massachusetts. Hi, Rick. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I really believe that Barack Obama is extremely electable, primarily because not only his past experience, and I know it doesn't seem very long, but being a senator almost works against a presidential candidate. If you look back at who's most recently been elected, you've got governors being elected and not senators. Senators, there's all this ammunition by their voting patterns to pick apart and use that past information to basically use against them in any election.
It's ammunition, but it's also experience, Rick. Do you think he's got the rest of the package to overcome that, just 2 years?
If you look at the experience of the candidates that he probably is going to face, if you look at Mr. Romney, for instance, where Mr. Romney has been a governor for 4 years.
Mitt Romney, Republican Massachusetts, former governor, now gunning for the Republican nomination, yes?
Correct, and I think he's got a very good shot at getting the nomination for the Republicans. But if you look at his experience, 4 years as a governor of Massachusetts, of which probably he was only in the state 2 years, but if prior to that,
right.
His experience is an Olympic Committee appointee, if you will.
Yeah, so not everybody comes with decades and decades, and let's not forget Obama's time in the Illinois legislature, but there's a thumbs up, Rick, and we hear it. Let's go to Aiken, South Carolina, and Miranda. Hi, Miranda. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm curious, is there any chance that we might see an Obama-Edwards ticket? Because I don't think Edwards has the charisma by himself, and I think Obama needs some strong support to make him more mainstream.
Let us pick it up. Jeffrey Goldberg, this goes right to the, you know, Rubik's Cube here. When you start to put together all these candidates, in the end, there will be a ticket. Does, you know, who can sit with who on a ticket like that?
Yeah.
Could you see Obama-Clinton? Could you see Obama-Edwards? Or flip those around any way you like?
Well, I could see a Clinton-Obama. I can't see an Obama-Edwards. I don't know why any man would subject himself to twice running for vice president.
Yes. Been there, done that.
I can't figure out why anybody would do it once. And so I can't imagine that Edwards would do that. One could plausibly see an Edwards-Obama. You can't see an Edwards-Clinton.
What about Obama-Clinton? Does that make sense?
I'd find that hard to believe.
Hillary's been the number two, in a sense, in the White House before also.
Exactly. You know, but Hillary had more power the first time than she would have the second time. I don't think you want to go on that path. So, you know, it could be, I mean, you know, there are, remember Mark Warner and Evan Bayh took themselves out of the presidential running. Mm-hmm. They didn't take themselves out of the vice presidential running.
Yeah. Let me get another caller here, if I may. David is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I think everyone seems to be missing one big piece. Everyone's talking about his experience, which really I don't think has very much to do with it. The main thing is that he is African-American, and in my opinion, this country will probably never elect someone. Racism is still very deep, even though people try to not address it. It's, as Studs Terkel said, the pink elephant in the living room that no one, you know, acknowledges. To the whole campaign, about Barack Obama, I keep thinking about Harold Ford, who was from Tennessee. He represented Tennessee. His father represented Memphis. They're from a Tennessee family, and still Tennessee couldn't come to terms and elect him.
Right. So there's the Harold Ford story, but then we have to look at the Barack Obama story itself, elected from the state of Illinois, which has all kinds of constituencies and colors going on. But there's the question right on the table: race. He's African American. Can that hurdle be cleared? Let's go to Chicago for some perspective on that. Barbara Ransby joins us. She's professor of African American Studies at the University and History at the University of Illinois, Chicago, a political activist herself, longtime watcher of the political scene on Chicago's South Side and statewide in Illinois, author of Ella Baker and the Black Freedom Movement. Barbara Ransby, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You've seen Barack Obama in all kinds of circumstances, and we want to get into the detail, but take on the big question that our caller David raises first. Will this country elect an African-American president?
Well, that's an interesting question. I wish I had the answer to that. But I do want to say something about race. I've seen Barack Obama in a number of contexts, but not in every context, and I do think the national political campaign will be a different context. It's very exciting. There's enormous potential. But it's very curious to me the way in which race is playing out in this campaign. I mean, a number of people talked about a post-racial America. We're not a post-racial America. We're not a post-racist America. So race will certainly factor in. But what we don't want to see, at least what I don't want to see with Barack Obama, is a sort of Jackie Robinson syndrome. That is, the first black has to be the safest black. I want to hear Barack Obama talk honestly and in a sophisticated way about race in this country, which I've heard him do, and I know he can. And I think he shouldn't shy away from that that issue. But the exciting aspect of this campaign, race is only one of them.
Absolutely.
I think we're all eager to see a change in the political game. And I think for Barack's campaign, it's really going to be a question of can principles trump pragmatism? And for any campaign, I think that internally they'll have to be willing to concede losing under certain circumstances. That is, it can't be about whatever it takes to win. It has to be about whatever it takes to move these issues and these principles forward. And if that can't happen at this moment, we're prepared to lose this election. And that's a very, very hard thing for politicians to say.
It sure is. Barbara, take us into the Illinois background here. I mean, Barack Obama certainly has shown he doesn't like to go negative. He won the U.S. Senate seat in Illinois, which has got a big urban black vote in Chicago and elsewhere, but also a huge white and often Republican vote downstate, rural communities. His Republican opponent in that Senate race sort of self-immolated on scandal. But what did Barack Obama show working both sides, all sides of the racial fence in that race about how he handles it, Barbara?
Well, I think, you know, this is a question of experience that keeps coming up. I mean, Barack Obama's been in this game for a decade plus. He entered the state legislature in 1996 and then had an unsuccessful congressional bid against Bobby Rush in 2000. And then the 2004 campaign was really unique in a number of ways. The Republican candidate, Jack Ryan, as you mentioned, bowed out of the campaign as a result of a scandal late in the game. Alan Keyes then stepped in, who was really a non-candidate. I mean, even the Republicans in Illinois were distancing themselves. So it was an easy campaign in that regard. But I think it is really important, the message that Barack Obama took. And I think race comes back into it again, because what one might see as black issues today, many of them are also economic issues today. And so I think he was able to take what are often associated with the left or with traditional black civil rights politicians and say to white working class people in Illinois, these are your issues too, health care, jobs, minimum wage, a whole number of issues that people resonate with because of the economics of it. And so I think he was able to do that. Now, the question of race and the fact that he's, you know, biracial being a factor, I mean, when you really think about that, all African Americans have a multiracial heritage. I mean, we can problematize this notion of race. So I think that's a part of it. But I also think his ability to take issues and frame them in a larger context has been really critically important.
And what do you make, Barbara, of the kind of cool response, at least the way we've seen it packaged so far, from Jesse Jackson, from Al Sharpton, from Harry Belafonte, saying we need to be careful about Obama, Belafonte saying we don't know what he's truly about. He's a young man in many ways to be admired, obviously very bright, speaks very well, cuts a handsome figure, but all of that is just the king's clothes. Who is the king? Where's this kind of foot-dragging in the African-American prominent league coming from?
Well, I wouldn't call that foot-dragging. I mean, one of your producers asked me this morning, was my support for Barack conditional? I don't think any support for any politician should be unconditional.
Mm-hmm.
If my son was running, my support would not be unconditional. I think we do have to ask Barack some very hard and difficult questions. The question of his stance on Iraq is one question. The question of whether, as a presidential candidate, he has a vision for resolving a situation in the Middle East, which I think, you know, issues of national security, issues of foreign policy, and all of this are very, very critical. So I think it's fair for Belafonte and the others to ask those questions. None of them have attacked him or been sharply critical, as far as I've heard. And they are very sharp-tongued
people who
don't hold back. And
right.
So if they were going to wage those criticisms, I think we would have heard them. But I think we all have to not just genuflect in front of a very articulate, principled guy, but ask difficult questions. And also, I think, help him answer those questions.
We're all for that. Let's take a call from Kaylin in Boston. Hi, Kaylin. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great. What do you think, Kaylin?
I think that the thing about Barack Obama is something that you guys have been saying already, and that is that he is very unifying. I come from a family where my parents are Republicans, and I am very Democratic.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we can't talk about politics, but when it comes to Barack Obama, we can. And we talk about the fact that both my parents and I would vote for this guy because he's so different.
Why would your parents, Republicans, dyed in the wool, why would they vote for Obama?
Because of the fact that he is not jaded yet. He still believes in the people. He's got the values that my parents see are important values. He's not really yet become hardened by Washington. And so even though he may not be, you know, everything that they're looking for in terms of, you know, the financial stuff and the Republican values, he's still somebody that's a good person and a good leader, and they see that he can bring our country places that many other candidates can't.
Kaylin, you put it well. I can hear the Obama camp scratching down notes on that. Thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, how about it? How do you see the cross-boundary appeal of this man?
Well, certainly there'd be resistance to him from some people on the count of his name, his race, but no Democrat would get those votes in any case, it seems to me. I can imagine that actually white voters would feel good about themselves voting for this man. To put it cynically, he's not the blackest of black men, so he's safe in that regard. But to put it positively, they could actually feel, my God, in the United States of America, we have a chance to have an African-American president. We have overcome. It's a way, in other words, I think that's a countervailing business, his race with white voters. It'll hurt him with some, but no Democrat would get them either anyway. And I think it'll help him, though, with many more, just because of what our caller was bringing up, that there is a feeling many people have that this guy is special. And it comes out of his, and I think the more they hear from him, the more they hear the views that he expresses in his books, the stronger I think that sense will be that he's different, because he keeps going back to common values. He keeps going back to that. You know, let's start at the Declaration of Independence. Mm-hmm. Let's begin there. Let's talk about the Constitution. Let's talk about the things we have in common. And if we still disagree, let's have empathy. Let's listen to the other person. Let's restore the deliberative character to democracy, which means a conversation, not a shouting match.
With a kind of foundational philosophy running
through
all that. Let me go to Joe in Middletown, Connecticut. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hello. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
To call Obama a black or African American is a racist remark. It totally ignores his European ancestry. Is he also Polish? Is he Irish? So we should not use the race issue at all.
Well, I take your point exactly, but what about Barbara Ransby's point that, you know, most African Americans have, and all kinds of Americans have blood from all over, and yet we do categorize.
Totally, totally true. Black society is racist in this case of Tiger Woods being called an African American when his dominant ancestry is Taiwanese.
But what about this? What about Obama's own position? I asked him when we had him on the show, Joe, I said, Barack Obama, are you African American? And he said, you know, in a very straightforward way, well, yes, I am. By definition, my father was African.
Exactly.
But I'm a particular kind of African American.
The definition of African American is wrong. It needs to be changed.
Barbara Ransby, let us put it to you.
Yeah, I'm happy you turned to me because, I mean, of course, it's not up to us to define race in this country. Race is really doesn't have any kind of scientific or biological basis to it, and anthropologists, social scientists have determined this. It's a social construct, which means society has created these categories that we have lived in and been imprisoned by, and us wishing them away does not erase them. So the reality in this country is the notion that if you have any African ancestry that you're deemed black. That's not something black people invented, certainly, but it's a reality, it's a history that we live with. Now, Barack Obama has said, I'm rooted in the black community, but I'm not limited by the black community. That actually has nothing to do with blood. You know, our blood is all the same, quite frankly.
Yep.
But he has rooted himself in a certain community in Chicago, the district that he represented in the Illinois State Legislature and so forth. So Barack Obama understands the complicated nature of race in this country. But what I think is interesting is the comment that he's not the blackest of black men, and therefore, you know, white America may find him acceptable. You know, we really should examine what we mean by that, because race becomes a proxy for other things. Does that mean he's not adamant in the sort of civil rights, social justice tradition that a Martin Luther King was? I don't know. But I hope, again, that Barack does not simply focus on the least common denominator. We've talked about him being a unifier now. Mm. I hate to be a naysayer here. But, we all want to feel good and be united. But united around what? I think feeling good is all fine, but we have to feel bad before we feel good. I think we need to, what I mean by that is we need to really critique and challenge and question some of the policies that have been made, and we need to make choices. And you can't be anti-war and pro-war, for example. You can't be for national health policy and against it. So the reality in politics, as in life, is that we have to make choices, and Barack's going to have to make choices, and everybody's not going to like those choices.
Yeah. Jeff Goldberg, let's go right to this big issue of war and Obama. He made a famous speech before he was in the Senate in Chicago, 2002, said this is a mistake. Where does he stand on it now? What questions is he up against as he gets into the ring here?
Well, to borrow from Barbara, I think he's for the war and against the war. I mean, this goes to this point. I think she made an excellent point about we're going to eventually have to come to this to these questions of what does he stand for? We can all feel good about this for a while, but you know, this is too important just to feel good about.
So what is his position now? What do you mean he's for and against the war?
Well, I don't mean he's for. I mean that he's taking a nuanced position that is going to get him in trouble on both sides. He comes into this with a huge advantage over Hillary Clinton and John Edwards, in that not only was he not in the Senate to vote for or against the Iraq Resolution in 2002, he made a speech in 2002 in which he laid out his critique of the idea of the Iraq War. It was, by the way, a very liberal interventionist speech. He was very critical of American support for so-called stable Arab governments like Egypt and Saudi Arabia.
And he wasn't saying never go to war. He was very clear
and he was
on
not,
that.
He said he's not against a war. He's against dumb wars. and this speech is, you could talk about inexperience and experience. A lot of very experienced people were for the war. This inexperienced guy was against the war. Most Americans now would agree that he was right and not the experienced people. That said, he's trying to do a very difficult thing right now. John Edwards is breaking a little bit left at the moment, talking about when I asked him a couple of weeks ago, I said, what's your give me the capsule version of your Iraq policy. He said, let's start leaving. Obama has a much more complicated understanding. He's talking about trying to constrain the president without voting against the funding of the continued war. He understands the consequences of leaving too soon. He understands the consequences of leaving late. He hasn't yet formulated an overarching strategic vision for what exactly we're going to do with Iraq and with the related problems of Iran and the Middle East peace process and everything else.
And he won't be given forever to do exactly that. Interestingly, Hillary Clinton this morning on NPR's Morning Edition saying it's time to cap the number and start moving troops out or at least away from the center of the fighting there. I want to get into Barack Obama's circle of advisors here, if we may. Joining us from Washington, Cassandra Butts. She was a classmate of Senator Barack Obama at Harvard Law School. He was the first black editor of the Law Review there. She's now part of his circle of advisors, currently a senior vice president at the Center for American Progress. She worked as a senior advisor to Dick Gephardt on his 2004 presidential campaign. Cassandra Butts, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
How does Barack Obama solve this kind of issue? Go to the war piece. Who's he going to consult? How's he going to decide? When's he going to get to the sort of razor edge of what his policy really is?
Well, he has, Tom, he has been consulting a range of very smart people on national security issues. If I could take a step back, just to say that a couple of months ago, Senator Obama gave a speech in which he laid out his approach to Iraq, and he is supportive of a phased withdrawal, and he believes that the only solution to the situation in Iraq is a political solution, and that the president's proposal to surge the troop buildup in Iraq is exacerbating a military solution that is not going to address the problem.
But would he fund the surge or not fund the surge?
Well, he has indicated that he supports the intent of Senator Kennedy's approach to this. He believes that his biggest concern is that we not do anything to undermine the troops that are presently in Iraq, and he will support an effort that will continue the funding to the troops that are in Iraq, continue the support for the troops that are there, but he believes that it's important that we initiate a phased withdrawal and that we surge diplomacy, not troops in Iraq.
Cassandra Butts, you're now in this, what we used to have friends of Bill and then friends of George of one kind and another, and now friends of Obama. You're in that circle. You've known him since law school. How does this guy think issues through? What's his style? Is it a kind of a, by committee? How does he deliberate? How does he come to, what he says into the camera?
Well, Barack is definitely someone who is thoughtful, as you've probably gotten to come to appreciate in seeing him on the national stage. He is a person of great intellect. The way he approaches these issues is that he becomes steeped in the issue. He will consult with again smart people. He will take their opinions under consideration, and he will come to his own conclusions that are definitely driven by the values that he brings to the issues, and also a very strong principled approach to the issues.
And why do you think he's doing this? It wasn't so long ago. I mean, he's clearly an ambitious man, but it wasn't so long ago that he was expressing real reservations. You know, the word was that his wife, Michelle, was not so sure about their lives being taken over by this kind of campaign. He hasn't been in Washington long. What flipped the trigger?
I believe that what he has said is pretty consistent with where he is at the moment and in kind of the thought process that's gotten him to the place where he has decided to form an exploratory committee. and that is that he's recognized that there is a real hunger in the American people for a different kind of politics, a politics that has more meaning, that gets away from kind of the smallness and the vitriol that we've seen in our politics, and allows the consideration for bigger issues and the bigger challenges facing.
But he could have done that, you know, in 2012, 2016. He's a young guy.
Certainly. But he believes at this point that this is something that he has to consider seriously. So he's decided to form the exploratory committee, and he'll make a final decision on February the 10th.
Do you have any doubt that he will, in fact, do it?
Well, there's a reason why he's engaging in this process. He's going to take the next 3.5 weeks. I should say that he's come to this decision after going through an internal exploratory process. Now he's doing a more public exploratory process. He's going to take the next 3 weeks to talk to folks that you would imagine that someone in his position would talk to and seek out to make a final decision on February the 10th. And I don't want to say that he is at a point now where he is seriously considering this, and he'll make a final decision on February the 10th.
There's the campaign line, but of course, all the feedback we've had from Chicago is it's done. He's going. Of course, we'll see on February 10th. Jim's calling from Greenwich, Connecticut. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning, Tom. How are you?
We're well.
I think the professor from UICC has made some excellent points about Barack. But I guess the point that I wanted to make is, as somebody who grew up in a small town in Illinois and whose mother still lives out there, what I'm seeing from people who live back in Western Illinois is just they're intrigued with somebody who doesn't want to triangulate, who doesn't want to motivate the base, but who wants to find a way to get some of the sharp elbow politics out of the way. And I don't see it as being black or as being biracial or multicultural. I just see the enthusiasm that I have and that my 82-year-old mother has as somebody who wants to change the way things are done.
Jim, thanks for the report. That sounds like the game-changing piece here. Let me get a call from Matt in Framingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to bring up the interesting point. I was watching the show 24 the other day.
The Fox War on Terror television drama.
Exactly, and it's extremely popular. And I noticed that of all the things they could have done in the script, they actually brought back a black president. And I'm wondering if that has anything to do with some sort of subliminal message or trying to ready the American people for this Barack campaign. Do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, we're going to talk about 24 on this show tomorrow. But, yes, it is interesting that there's a black president there. Cassandra Butts, if Hollywood, if Fox TV is making a black man the president, does that say something, anything? Does that mean the country's ready?
Well, that means that Fox TV believes the country is ready, I suppose, and that they think that having a black person in the presidency is something that's going to attract viewers, and I can't disagree with them on that point.
Cassandra, I know we've got to let you go, but we appreciate your being with us. Cassandra Butts at the Center for American Progress and there in the Obama Inner Circle. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Let me go to Alex in Providence, Rhode Island. Alex, you're on the air.
Hi, I wanted to direct this question to Cassandra, and I hate to make this into such a racial topic, but I was wondering if she thought that Barack could swing the conservative voters who were in the ethnic community, in other words, Latinos, African Americans, and what she had to say to that.
Conservative ethnics. Let me put that to our panel. Barbara Ransby, you're with us in Chicago. How has Barack Obama done historically with conservative people of color?
Conservative people of color. Well, it depends. As I think Barack Obama himself has said, these terms conservative and liberal are terms that are very much in flux. And so there are people who are, you know, progressive or liberal on economic issues, conservative on social issues. So unless we tease out what we mean by conservative, I'm not sure. I mean, as a number of callers have indicated, there are certainly Republicans prepared to vote for what they think Barack represents or what he actually represents. And there are certainly liberals and people on the left prepared to support him. But I would actually, I think underlying some of these questions is a bigger question, and that is, what do we mean by game changing? And if game changing means sort of revisiting the political map, I think it really has to also mean getting beyond a single great American hero. I mean, the reasons that we vote for people, quite frankly, are problematic. I mean, if someone is going to vote for Barack because he's good looking and he just makes them feel good, I'm all for them voting for him, but that's really not a good reason to vote for him. And I would like to see, instead of a sort of friends of Obama, many activists in Chicago have talked about something called GROW, or Grassroots Obama to Win, which is really delinking the campaign from a single individual, but talking about what do grassroots people really want to see in national politics in this country, and how can Barack make that happen and embody that in his campaign. And I think that kind of language has an appeal across the spectrum.
Jeffrey Goldberg, Barack Obama would clearly like to get away from liberal, conservative kind of language. But then if you look at his voting record, a very low rating from the kind of conservative index that follows that. He's strong for abortion rights. He's strong for help for the poor. He's got the positions that have been the hallmarks of the liberal candidate. Yet he does have a different way of describing the country and its politics and its challenges. Do you think he can surmount, get away, transcend that kind of measure?
To some degree, yes. But I pointed out in the New Yorker last week that one of the things that he does on these foreign policy questions, at least, is he sounds rhetorically hawkish, but in fact is in policy more of a liberal Democrat. And the fact is that Barack Obama is a mainstream liberal, and it's only a matter of time before that's pointed out by his adversaries in this process. And you can't escape that, because Barbara's exactly right. After we all feel good about this, we're going to want to know what he's going to do if he's president of the United States. And so no one can escape the close scrutiny of a record, the close scrutiny of beliefs. But it's very clever what he's done so far, in that Audacity of Hope, he talks about
memoir,
how his new book, he talks about how Democrats or liberals have to recognize that Osama bin Laden is not Ho Chi Minh. In other words, Osama is a much more dangerous figure to American national security than Ho Chi Minh ever was. So he makes these stabs at reaching for the center, the center right. But policy wise, we don't see anything like that yet.
Let me go to Hagerstown, Maryland for a moment. Gabe is calling. Hi, Gabe. You're on the air.
Hello. My question is, with all the things going on outside of America and the people that America has to deal with, such as Ahmadinejad in Iran, Kim Jong-il in Korea,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's very scary out there. I mean, we have Ahmadinejad who is saying that the Holocaust never happened, that he wants to wipe Israel off the face of the earth.
So where are you going with this, Gabe? Has George Bush been licking those problems, or you think Obama cannot or can, or what?
Well, you know, George Bush has been in office, and I think that he is trying to deal with these problems.
Do you see progress?
I have not seen progress yet.
Okay, so what's your question on Obama?
What about Obama do we think is going to be able to confront these problems?
Let's pick it up. Jeff, that goes to your neck of the woods. He's talked about his experience. What does he say when he gets this question? Do you have the chops?
He doesn't mention North Korea once in his new book, I would point out, and as I pointed out. He might have the chops. Look, I mean, what have we learned over the past 6 years? That experience is not the only qualification for running a sound foreign policy. That said, you could talk all you want about a surge in diplomacy. That's very nice language, but that assumes a rational interlocutor on the other end, and he hasn't spoken. And to be fair, very few of the other candidates have spoken. Just exactly what do you do to manage the Iran problem? And we haven't heard that yet, and we're not in that phase of the campaign yet, maybe, but we're very soon going to have to be.
Jack Beatty, we've just got a minute here. Where do you see this candidacy, if and when it's made official February 10th, and everybody pretty much expecting it will be, where do you see it pointing the national conversation about these very large problems?
Well, obviously, he's going to try to transcend some of them and reposition himself in relation to them. But, you know, the more you look at presidential campaigns, the clearer it stands out. They're decided on valence issues, not political issues, on issues like, is the economy good or not? Has the government been run well or not? Is this candidate pleasing or not? And on that last one, pleasingness, the Q rating, advertisers call it, personality, this guy's got it. And it's the obvious thing about him that he's likable. His voice is likable. If you heard Hillary Clinton's voice this morning on the radio, it was hard. And there it is. I mean, he's going to be running against somebody who doesn't have that kind of Q rating, and that's what decides elections, I think, at the end, not position issues.
Well, though the questions will fly, and we will see what it comes down to. I want to thank each of you for being with us today. Barbara Ransby in Chicago, it was great having you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Jeffrey Goldberg of The New Yorker in Washington. Jeffrey, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty, much more to come on this front. Thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.